we have Diana Clift, who is a vice president of the network, and adding life to years reminds me of the famous quotation from Abraham Lincoln, who said it's not the amount of years in your life that count, but the amount of life in your years. And so Di has packed it in, and I've no doubt that she will continue to pack it in, and she will give us some pearls from her life experience. So Di, thank you very much.
Cheers, thank you. I came across an amazing statistic yesterday, and I don't know if this is part of the post-truth era, but the statistic was that more than half the people who have reached the age of 65 and over who have ever lived are living now, which is an amazing thought. And certainly in this country, over 65s will very soon be one in five of the population. And not surprisingly, this is generally viewed as a problem, a burden on the working population. I think this is a most exciting and thrilling new resource. And I love this phrase that Mary Catherine Bateson said about adulthood too, active wisdom. That's it. So I think we have a wonderful new resource here, and for the individual, I think it is a whole new phase of life. It is not retirement, and it's not more of the same. And we actually have to use this resource. Well, I had fun browsing through the Office of National Statistics, and you look at life expectancy at age 65, and it has increased by a quarter in just 25 years. It is now an average of 20 years at age 65. Now, that masks a lot of regional differences. And if you live down the road here in Kensington and Chelsea, you can expect, if you're a man, to live about 23 years from the age of 65. If you're a woman, nearly 25 years. And I'm pleased to say the gender gap narrows the older you get. So it narrows to almost nothing. So men, if you have made it through to 65, you will live a very long time, probably. So 20 to 25 years is far too long to be retired, and it is enough time to retrain completely, do an entirely new occupation, take up an entirely new career. It would be, except for the bad news, which is that most of us can expect several years of debilitating illness in old age. That is the problem. That's what we have to tackle. So we've got to improve health and well-being. And I'm going to propose that a few changes in attitudes, outlook, and behavior can go some way towards achieving that. I'm very excited by several large-scale prospective studies looking at large populations over a period of many years, which show all of them are agreed that the most important factor in predicting a life expectancy and health is attitude. A positive outlook gives you a huge advantage, and crucially, a sense of purpose. So an optimistic outlook and a sense of purpose are more significant than diet, exercise, weight, alcohol, all the other obvious variables. And now I want to move on to... Oh, I should just, of course, add to that those are statistical predictions, because we all know people with wonderfully positive outlooks who succumb to cancer, heart disease, whatever. We've all known people like that, and it is not their fault. It is only one variable. We also equally know frightful old curmudgeons who go on living forever, so it is a statistical prediction. And now I want to move on to some very interesting work done by Ellen Langer's group. How am I supposed to move this on? Oh. Arrow down. There we are. By Ellen Langer's group. Ellen Langer is professor of experimental psychology at Harvard, and her group have been studying age-related aspects of age over the last 40 years. And she carried out a most interesting experiment in 1979, in which a group of elderly men were taken to a remote monastery that was kitted out as if it were 1959. And they lived for a week in total immersion in 1959. So the news, the TV programs, the radio, the music, the decor, the photos, everything was 1959. And at the end of that week, they were younger by every criterion. They were not just mentally younger, they were physiologically younger. Their hearing was better. Their sight was better. And I love this. Their fingers were longer. They were taller. You know, it had got right into their joints, this rejuvenation. It's an amazing study, and it was repeated in 2010 for a BBC documentary called The Young Ones. It was a wonderful documentary, and I would love to get it in some form, but I can't find it. It doesn't seem to be available. And in this experiment, and it was conducted under the supervision of Ellen Langer, this group of elderly celebrities was taken to a house that was kitted out as 1975. So they had total immersion in 1975 for a week. They are, from the top left, clockwise, Liz Smith, the actress, Lionel Blair was the dancer and choreographer. I think the next one is Derek Jameson, who was a newspaper editor. Then Sylvia Sims, actress. Then Dickie Bird, who was a cricket umpire, commentator. And Kenneth Kendall, a newsreader. All of them were in their 70s and 80s. Some of them had had strokes. One of them was in a wheelchair. I think that was Sylvia Sims, had very bad back. And interestingly, not only were they immersed in 1975, but they had to look after themselves, and they were given jobs to do, responsibilities. And the jobs were designed to appeal to them, either using their experience or their interests. So, for instance, Lionel Blair was required to choreograph a dance for a group of dancers. Of course, he loved doing that. Kenneth Kendall was given a couple of dogs to look after for the week. One of them was given, had to entertain children. I mean, a whole range of things they were required to do. And the results were just as spectacular as Ellen Langer's first experiment. They all came out years younger. Not only was this only one week, but during that week, on the Wednesday, the experimenter sent in a team of carers in white coats to look after them, and they all relapsed that one day. But by the end of the week, they were so much better, and Sylvia Sims said movingly that she had been in intense pain beforehand and could barely walk. And she hardly noticed it afterwards. And the rejuvenation seemed to be lasting too. I don't know how long for, because I only saw follow-up a few months later. So The power of that suggestion is enormous. And of course, the converse is also true. You can very easily think yourself old, and I know quite a few people who have done that. And some experiments done with groups of young students have shown that very subtle priming can affect your behavior. And a group were given word games to do that were peppered with words associated with age, like grey, wrinkled, wise. And that group walked more slowly as they came out of the test room than when they went in, whereas another group who were given words associated with youth and vitality came bounding out. So the processes are very subtle, and we can all, we are all subjected to priming all the time. So this leads me on to a useful working model, an imaginative model more than a hypothesis, but it's very helpful. I would say it's useful to think of the body as being embedded in mind, that mind surrounds the body, and mind is the primary environment of the body. Now, of course, this doesn't hold true in all instances, because I could right now go and jump off that balcony convinced I could fly, and I would still plummet to the ground and my body would suffer the consequences. So it's not always true, but there are many occasions in which it is. And in fact, there are fascinating anecdotal examples from disasters where people do not notice their own injuries. They actually are involved in the rescue work. They seem to have even additional strength. They don't feel any pain. They don't know that they are seriously injured themselves until they have a chance to sort of see the blood, and then the pain kicks in and so on. But it looks as if in that instance, the shock and everything somehow shields the body from what's happened to it. A more cheerful example, I love this. This is my favorite. There have been various experiments that show that thinking about lifting heavy weights can put on muscle mass without you having to do a thing. I love it. I mean, and not a huge amount of thinking either. There was a group who just had to envisage lifting weights like that for 10 or 15 minutes a day, just over a month, and they put on 13% of muscle on their biceps. I mean, so I'm working on this, and I have a virtual exercise program that I use in my practice that I designed really for my weight loss clients particularly, but for others as well, for whom actually doing intense exercise is really difficult or impossible. So I wonder if just imagining yourself doing an intense cardiovascular workout can actually have a physiological benefits. And the answer is, of course, I don't know, because I haven't, this is not science yet. I don't have a control group. I don't have the necessary measures. I would love to do this, so if anybody wants to fund me, it's a piece of research I'm itching to do. But lots of people have done my virtual exercise program, and they all report there's no doubt that you absolutely feel you've had your sprint when you listen to the recording, and I listen to them myself, and I really feel I've had a workout. And I've done some customized ones, particularly for people with arthritis. And they have reported benefits. They feel they loosen up. They feel they can move more easily. So interesting one. Anyway, so those are a couple of examples of mind as the environment of the body. And the next example I particularly love, and this is Olga Kotelko, who was a very versatile track and field athlete. She competed in 11 different types of event over a period of about 16 years. To international competition level, she won countless medals. And she started training when she was 77. And she continued until competing internationally until she dropped dead, age 95. And here she is. Isn't that great? Wouldn't you like to be like that when you were 90? And she consented to be examined and studied by a number of universities, actually various teams, subjected her to all sorts of tests and screenings. And in a way, the fascinating thing is that she wasn't that abnormal. Her genes were perfectly normal, her basic musculature, she wasn't a particularly athletic build or anything. What they did find was her outlook was extraordinary. Her outlook was amazing. She was mentally very sharp and very focused and very cheerful and motivated. She must have been disappointed that she dropped dead at 95. Her aim was still to be competing at 120. But she did pretty well. And the fact that she was so normal is reflected by the remarkable discovery that she had advanced osteoporosis. Her skeleton weighed about 1.6 kilos, which is 3.5 pounds, and yet she did that sort of thing without getting any fractures. Also, when they scanned her brain, they found lesions in the white matter that you would associate, you would expect in a woman in her 90s, but normally would be associated with cognitive impairment. Not in her case. And this is particularly hopeful sign, I think. Well, everything about Olga Kotelko is hopeful. Would that we could all be even a fraction as active as that and then just drop dead at 95. That would be the ideal. But when you think about Alzheimer's, of course, you're aware of the frightful brain damage that underlies the condition. And one tends to think, well, when there's that degree of objective damage to the brain, everything is lost. You know, what can one do? And yet there's a lot of very hopeful research. I won't have time to go into much of it, but into Alzheimer's and how you can alleviate symptoms and how you can reverse some of the symptoms. It's not that simple. And here is another brain. On the right-hand side, you've got a normal brain. On the left-hand side, and this was reported in The Lancet in 2007, you have the brain of a 44-year-old civil servant with a family, a couple of kids, leading a completely normal life. And there's nothing in it. maybe it's neuroplasticity or whatever it is not a simple connection. There is more to it than just brain equals mind. And now I'm going to invert my own model, and I'm going to suggest that actually the body is the environment of the mind, and mind is embedded in body. And you can do things with the body that will impact on the mind. And there's lots of research on things like expression. You may have seen it. It was very popular for a while. It's partly been debunked, I think, that if you're made to smile, even if you don't know you're smiling, it makes you feel more cheerful. Certainly, there is lots of evidence that if you stand up straight, you look up, you feel more confident. If you walk faster, you feel more cheerful and you feel younger. And that's actually been used as a therapy for severely depressed patients hospitalized with depression. If you can just get them to walk, if you can get that spring in their step, they start to feel better. And it's almost as if the mind looks around the body and says, oh, I'm smiling, I'm standing up straight, I must be young and healthy, or I must be cheerful. Or it's sort of partly that way around. And there's a lot in the popular press, you will, I'm sure, have seen about power poses. And now we're all supposed, apparently, before you even get up in the morning, before you even get up, you do your stretches, you fill the space, and you feel immediately confident and determined, and, you know, you adopt power poses at work, and everybody, you cower before me, you see, as I show my tremendous self-belief, which, as we all know, is all you need to become president of the USA. It's amazing, isn't it? But of all the things you can do with the body to influence the mind, exercise is the most significant. Exercise is not just physically incredibly good for you. It keeps your mind young and sharp. It's very, very good. So I think that is an example of the body being the environment of the mind. And the best form of exercise is dancing. It's the best form of exercise, and it has to do, I think, with music, which brings out, I think both the models apply with music. The mind as environment of the body as environment of the mind, and you get a sort of feedback loop working that is puts you on an upward spiral, I think, with participatory music. I have worked for 15 years alongside my hypnotherapy as in a duo as an entertainer at care homes. And we play the popular songs of the 20th century that the residents will be familiar with, and we encourage them to join in every way they can. And it is remarkable how even those with Alzheimer's who no longer recognize their own children will remember the words of the old songs. And when they do join in, if you can get them, you've got to make eye contact, you've got to sort of draw them in, and they become animated, and they remember the words, and they can move gracefully to music. Even if they can't move at all otherwise, they will move. They'll be able to tap out a rhythm. They'll be able to express. You can dance with almost hardly any of your body. Just a little bit. Very, very subtle ways you can dance. And when people are encouraged to dance, if you've got good carers who get them up and get them moving, they are better in every respect. And they're easier to look after, of course, because they are more mobile. So participatory music is a wonderful thing, and I'm so pleased that there are numerous experiments going on in this, like the Alzheimer's choirs that are springing up all over the place. What a wonderful thing. That's such a good idea. And I would like to mention that because we care homes get a terrible press, because, of course, when they're bad, they're very bad and disastrous. But there are very, very good things going on in care homes. And residents are being given responsibilities. They are looking after houseplants or pets or being involved in the management. And there's a lovely experiment in Deventer in Holland. I always love win-win things, and this is a wonderful win-win situation. A care home has offered free accommodation to students in return for a few hours of household chores, but also hanging out with the residents, spending time with the residents, talking to the residents. And of course, this is hugely beneficial both ways. It benefits the elderly, it benefits the students get free accommodation, win-win. I love it. And now, how am I doing for time? Do we have a... I've run out of time. Very, very quickly then. I want to finish with an anecdote. I met a colleague of my husband's, Franco, a few months ago. He's an Italian living in Canada. And he told me about his mother, Ines, who is was a typical Italian housewife and mother, happily married, loved her cooking, loved her garden, didn't deal with the financial side of things. Her husband dealt with that, you know, never learned to use a computer or anything like that. She was widowed at age 84 and went into steep decline. She lost interest in everything. She stopped going out, and she deteriorated mentally and physically very severely. She got so she was so crippled she could hardly move. And worryingly to her family, she was getting confused, losing her memory, generally unable to cope. They were thinking she'd have to go into a home. And then something changed, and we're not quite sure what the trigger was. Probably the fact that she had a lot of friends in the village, and somebody persuaded her to go out. And she started to take an interest in life again. And she started to invite people back to hers and started cooking again. And then, of course, she wanted her fresh ingredients, so she started gardening again. And then she decided to take up classes, and she learnt about computers, and she now emails and Skypes her family around the world. And there she is in her garden. She's 90. So even a steep decline like that could be reversed, which I find wonderful. So I want you all, please, to keep dancing. And tonight, I have a suggestion for you. Tonight, when you go home, do not listen to the news. I tell you now, it will be horrendous. Spare yourself that. Find some music that you associate with a peak time in your life, falling in love. Go and find that track and play it, move to it, dance to it, and then see how you feel. Keep dancing.